Okay, many years ago, when I was kind of distressed with IRPI and other radical economists who were saying, analyzing like Marx did mostly, capitalism, but not really talking much about an alternative, and thinking about Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, because he said in order to make a paradigm change in scientific theory, you had to have the present paradigm had to be crumbling or failing in a significant manner. There had to be a better idea, and then there needed to be a dedicated group of people in order to make the transition from one paradigm to another. I thought, gee, that's very analogous to what's needed in order to foment revolution. I thought that'll make a good paper. I discovered Thomas Kuhn had already written that paper. He made that analogy already. And it's going to be a big difference, like you were kind of alluding to, between defending revolution in a country which is maybe the last bastion of capitalism and powerful, like the United States, and trying to defend it in Peru or Nepal or some other place, which is a small country. And so you have a very different kind of problem that you face. But even in the larger countries, we've seen revolutions fail in the Soviet Union, in China. And even though they made some efforts to try to maintain revolution, you know, like in the admission to the Communist Party. So he's saying, you know, there is a tendency for academics and the better educated people who are more articulate to gain power. And so they would have slots aligned. They have to have so many youth. You have to have so many working class people, so many peasants, so many women in order to try to maintain the dictatorship of the proletariat. Well, we know ultimately that failed. Okay, now, I think that's an important question long term. It's not just the question of how we get there, but how do you keep it after you succeed? How do you keep the dictatorship of the proletariat without losing it, without having a counter-revolution?
Well, thank you. That's a good question. It's also a very big question. Well, I think you're right. We've had a wave of socialist, you know, socialist revolutions and experience in socialist society. I've referred to this as the end of a stage, and now we're at the beginning of a new stage. So it's very important to sum up the experience of that first stage and try to learn from the positive things, but also, you know, what were the shortcomings, what were mistakes that were made, and what were also objective difficulties that they were trying to deal with, and how do we deal with them better? But not that these things will repeat themselves in the same form, but still, you can learn a lot from the basic problems and contradictions that they were attempting to deal with. To take one particular aspect of what you raised, the thing about having, you know, sort of, it reminds me a little bit of like identity politics in this country, that approach to the party. You know, you have, you know, different segments of society that you think are more favorable to revolution and to continuing to build socialism, and you try to sort of mechanically handle the problem by assigning slots to them. And that's not really ultimately a solution to it, because one of the things that we've learned, and Mao brought this out very sharply, is the key thing about a party and the members of the party is, and the leadership of the party, is what line they have, how they understand the world, what methodology they use to analyze the problems they're up against and to solve those problems and to mobilize people to actually deal with the reality that they're confronting. And absent that, without that, it doesn't matter, you know, what the composition will be. People can still be led back down the path to the old society. And this is one of the things we've learned. It's been a very bitter lesson. I think there are two things. One is, There were objective problems that these revolutions faced. And then there's a question of what methods the leaders in particular used to try to deal with those problems. The Soviet Union, when it emerged, didn't expect, including, and the leaders of it didn't expect, including Lenin, to be all on their own. One of the reasons, for example, that Lenin, when during the Civil War in Russia, tried to carry the revolution into Poland was because he thought that not only would it be important to actually win Poland, but that that would be sort of a spring to set loose revolution in Germany. And as we know, that in that same period, revolution in Germany failed and was crushed, we should say, and drowned in blood. And, you know, people like Rosa Luxemburg were murdered as part of that process. And so that didn't succeed, and they didn't even succeed in taking Poland. So then at that point, they were kind of thrown back. Okay, here we are all on our own. There's no other successful socialist revolution. Hungary, they had a socialist government for about 6 months and it was crushed. And basically, there's nothing else here. And this is not what they had expected to emerge out of World War I. You know, first of all, there was this whole orientation that all the socialist parties that existed going into World War I had pledged at conferences like Basel in 1912 that when the war that they could see was coming broke out, they wouldn't support their own governments. But it was really only the Bolsheviks and a few others that actually carried through on that. And all these other parties, like the big German Socialist Party, Social Democratic Party, betrayed that because they had built their whole orientation, their whole line was based on the idea that they could build up their strength in the trade unions, win seats in parliament, build up their, you know, associations and society, and eventually, pretty much through peaceful means, they could come to a position where they'd be strong enough to institute socialism. And when the war broke out, all that got shattered. And the illusory nature of all that was completely exposed. And the Lukowski and others, leaders of the party, just collapsed in the face of that, as Lenin pointed out. So the Bolsheviks had been counting on a revolution in Germany in particular. And for all these reasons and more, there was no revolution in Germany. So then they had to fall back and figure out what to do. And there was a big, as you know, I'm sure, a big struggle broke out inside the Bolshevik, the Communist Party, the Soviet Union, whether it was even possible to build socialism in one country, given that the other revolutions had either been betrayed or failed or crushed. And Lenin came up with a temporary solution because their economy was in a shambles. You know, they had suffered the whole, you know, the whole devastation of World War I. Then there was a civil war of several years. Not only the reactionary generals and others fought them, but also various imperialists backed them or even sent small contingents of the army, of their armies, to fight them. So they had to try to repair and restore any kind of a functioning economy. And Lenin said, all right, what we have to do is adopt what he called a new economic policy, which won't be immediately socialist, but will bring in, you know, elements, including, you know, capitalists from other countries and even capitalist elements inside the Soviet Union, who within and restricted somewhat by the dictatorship of the proletariat, the socialist government, will help us restore the economy. So that's what they set out to do in the early 1920s, and then Lenin died. And then they were confronted with, you know, a crisis of leadership and a crisis of direction, how to go and where to go. And really, only Stalin had any kind of program for building socialism inside the Soviet Union. And, you know, others like Bukharin, who was a leader of the Bolshevik Party, took the position that they basically had to let capitalism develop unfettered for a whole long period of time in order to create the material requirements, the economic requirements for socialism, which would have been a disaster. That would have meant they go right back to capitalism in both the countryside and the city. And then Trotsky basically had the line that, you know, with the failure of the World Revolution, wasn't really much they could do. They could militarize the trade unions and basically make the whole economy like run like a military. And that would have been a disaster too. So it fell to Stalin to actually come up with a line of building socialism in one country. But as Mao said about Stalin, he was educated in a religious seminary, and he never completely got that out of him. And this was a problem methodologically that, you know, in the early years, Mao also said, in the early years of the Soviet Union, they had nothing to rely on except the masses, so they relied on the masses. Then once they built themselves up a bit that way, they stopped relying on the masses. And I think this is a big phenomenon. They didn't really understand, and Stalin's methodology, you know, limited their ability to understand that you have to have a thoroughgoing revolution in every sphere of society, including in what we call the superstructure, the politics, the culture, and the ideology, and not just in the economics, that it isn't enough just to develop the economy or even just to make the ownership by the state or by collective groups of people. That you have to transform the thinking, the culture, and the political institutions and the forms of political rule through which the masses can really be drawn in. And so Stalin attempted to build socialism in one country and made real advances and contributions, but at the same time there was a lot of seeds of future undoing in that. They didn't really understand the peasantry very well in Russia, ironically, even though the country was 80-90% peasants. But they based their revolution, you know, according to sort of the classical Marxist view, they based it in the working class in the cities, which was a small part of the population. And right at the time of the uprising, the revolution in 1917, Lenin started paying more attention to the peasantry and you know, to determining what were their demands, immediate demands, and how that could be sort of merged into a socialist program. But then again, you know, Lenin died, and they really didn't have much experience working among the peasantry, except maybe in the army, where a lot of the army was peasants. So how do you go about transforming agriculture and industry to a socialist agriculture and industry and integrating them correctly? And actually doing this by relying on the conscious initiative of the masses of people? Well, Stalin followed sort of a classic model of feeling that the key thing was to develop heavy industry. That if you developed heavy industry, then you could bring agriculture along in its wake, so to speak, because then you could provide machinery, and technology for agriculture, and then you could develop agriculture and collectivize it more when you had more tractors and so on. And he also saw the problem of defending the country largely in the same way. He made the statement in the context of World War II, for example, that whoever has the most tanks and planes will win the war. So from about the early 30s on, Stalin began to be more and more concerned, and not without justification, with the potential of an attack from Germany. And especially, I'm having to jump around a bit here, but I'm trying to get to the full sweep of your question. Especially after the Nazis came fully to power in Germany in the early 30s and completely smashed what was a very powerful Communist Party in Germany at that time. Then things changed radically inside the Soviet Union in a further direction, because they had put a lot of hopes on revolution in Germany in the 30s. There was a massive depression. There was a very large communist movement. Millions of people voted for it and supported it in various ways. But they weren't really, that party was still not prepared to actually for what was coming and didn't really have a consistently revolutionary program. And you know, there's that famous statement by Pastor Niemöller. He gets quoted a lot of times. First they came for this, and then they came for that. A lot of people don't remember that the first ones they came for were the communists, and then down the line with others. And that's true. That is, they decimated the communists when the Nazis came to power and destroyed that party. And this, in turn, had a big impact back in the Soviet Union. You can see the effect of this if you look at the documents from the International Communist Movement, which Stalin was leading. Up till about 1934, there's a lot of talk about building revolutionary movements in the capitalist countries and in the colonial countries and so on. After 1934 and beginning around 35, that changed completely, and they began to adopt the whole United Front Against Fascism program, which went along with a foreign policy of basically trying to ally with the imperialist states like England and France that were opposed to and threatened by Germany. And at that point, things changed within the Soviet Union as well. And I think the effect of the defeat once again in Germany, and if you want to put it this way, the lights kind of went out in the Soviet Union to a certain degree in terms of the leadership, adopting other than a revolutionary orientation. And if you combine that with the thing I was saying earlier, there were certain mechanical tendencies to see that the key thing was just to put overwhelming emphasis on building up heavy industry and not to bring forward the peasantry in a more conscious way, but actually, in fact, to sort of take a wealth produced by the peasantry and put it overwhelmingly and disproportionately into building up heavy industry, then this created a lot of problems. When that combined with the defeat in Germany and their sort of giving up to a certain degree on the prospect of revolution immediately in other countries, then they went into a whole thing of basically trying to ally with these various imperialists to defeat the attack that they could see was coming from, or very likely was coming from, Nazi Germany. I don't have time to go into all the history, but that was rebuffed by Germany and France and the U.S., and then they maneuvered and signed a pact with Nazi Germany themselves in order to buy time, and then were attacked. And during World War II, they substituted to a very significant degree a revolutionary line with a straight-up sort of classical patriotic line. This was the period when Ivan the Terrible and these various czars who'd, driven out invaders were being upheld as icons of national unity. And they did face it. I mean, after all, they lost 20 million people in World War II. This is not a minor matter they were confronting, so I don't mean to make light of it. But in the face of that, some of the errors in methodology that were already there got really accentuated, and they began to go back on a lot of what Lenin had fought for in the communist movement, such as the idea that workers in the imperialist countries don't have a fatherland to defend and shouldn't support their own government in imperialist wars. Well, the Soviet Union during World War II began to put out, well, things have changed. Workers have trade unions now. They have more rights. They have something to defend, because that was, frankly, they were practicing a certain kind of realpolitik. They were faced with a severe threat from Germany, and so everything was being bent and twisted to, you know, rationalize and go along with this united front, including with other imperialists, that they wanted to form against Germany, and eventually did form after the U.S. got into the war, and after Britain and France got into the war, and the Soviet Union came in 1941. So all of these problems were sort of the larger backdrop for some of the things that you were raising. I'm just trying to set a certain broader and underlying context and foundation for these problems. Mao also said about Stalin that Stalin paid a lot of attention to the economic base, but not to the superstructure. In other words, he paid a lot of attention to developing the economy and even to socializing some of the relations of production. But he only saw that in more narrow terms. In other words, to Stalin, really the key thing was just the system of ownership. If the ownership were formally state, if the economy were formally owned by the state or by collective groups of peasants, then that made it socialist. One of the things that got brought forward by Mao and others in the Cultural Revolution is that the economic relations are more complicated than that and involve more aspects than that. And they brought out a statement by Lenin that show that the relations of production involve not just the ownership system, whether it's privately owned by individuals or owned by the government. Because you can have state capitalism where the government owns everything, but if the relations that go along with that are still exploitive, it's just a form of capitalism. That's what they had in the Soviet Union from the time of Khrushchev. And the other key things about the relations of production are, what are the, you know, this division of labor I was talking about, for example, between mental and manual work. What are you doing about overcoming that? And also the system of distribution. What are you doing about overcoming inequalities in the system of distribution? In other words, what people get for their work, what income they have. What are you doing about the income inequalities in society? To a large degree, Stalin ignored those other two aspects of the relations of production, the division of labor of people in work and the distribution according to work. And he didn't see in any kind of full or clear way the need to overcome and transform the inequalities in that. And he only put one-sided and almost complete emphasis on just building up the state ownership or the collective ownership of the collective farms in the countryside. And so here's the problem. This goes back to your point about having certain quotas in the party. Even when they brought forward workers and peasants to be engineers and technicians and to fill administrative and political posts in the society, even if the origins of the people come from the working class, you're not getting rid of the fact that they now occupy a different and more privileged position than other people who are not in those positions of being engineers, technicians, administrators, political leaders, and so on. And that merely changing the origins of the people who are in these positions will not change the fundamental divisions in the society. It's more profound than just the origins of people. You know, there's an old joke that the Soviet Union, that Khrushchev supposedly went and met with somebody in the Chinese party, and Khrushchev was going on and on about, well, you say that we're not a real socialist society, we're revisionist and all this kind of thing, but look at me. I'm the son of three generations of working class. You know, I come from the working class. And then he appointed someone I thought might have been Joe and Lai, which is problematical because he ended up a revisionist too, but never mind that part. Just to illustrate, this is before he became a revisionist, okay? And then he turned to Joe and Lai and said, look at you, you're from an aristocratic family in China. And the story goes that Joe and Lai looked at him and said, well, it looks like we both betrayed our classes. And that's the complexity of it. You know, Khrushchev might have come out of the working class, but once he's the head of state, he's not in the working class. You haven't, just by that means, eliminated the difference between mental and manual labor, between the masses of people who are still in one position and people who occupy positions of administration or technicians or engineers or scientists or whatever. And Stalin didn't really grasp this. And it is a complex problem because here's the complex interplay of things that makes it hard. In order to overcome those divisions, you can't just reshuffle the deck and say, okay, now we're not going to have any more inequalities, because those inequalities will reassert themselves when you're up against the reality of having to feed people and build hospitals and build schools and, yes, build an army and so on. You have to get those things done. And if you have people in positions who don't know how to do what needs to be done in order to plan and carry out those things, they won't happen. The society will fall apart or be crushed by its enemies. So how do you overcome these differences? Mao said, the system of ownership at any given time provides a certain framework or limitation within which we can make many changes. What he was getting at is, okay, look, in China, for example, they still had, they had state ownership of industry, say by the 1960s, in the countryside, they still mainly relied on cooperatives or collectives of peasants working together. And within, maybe a group of a few hundred peasants, they'd have teams that would work together. And the way that income was distributed was still distributed on the basis of the team members deciding to distribute to members of their team, maybe a couple of dozen people, according to how much work they did. So this was still a low level of ownership and distribution of the wealth that was created. But Mao said we can still make changes within that framework. For example, they had these large public works projects that would combine a number of villages to all work on roads or dams or hydroelectric plants and things like that, which began to break down some of these narrow differences where everything was just dependent on the work team and distributed according to what the work team did. But still, in order to overcome these differences, you have to get to the point where you can produce the material requirements of society for the basic needs of the people in an expanding way, where you can put aside things for future development, so you're not always just reproducing the same level, where you can have things set aside for natural disasters, floods, hurricanes, whatever, where you can actually have an army to defend your revolution. You have to be able to do all that in a short enough period of time in terms of how much people work during a day, so that you can free people up to begin learning how to do all these other things. And this is a very acute contradiction. In other words, if you could produce all that stuff I was just talking about in 4 hours labor, there'd be a lot of time left in the day for people to learn how to, write poetry, study science, engineering, what have you, and take part in political decision making. But if it takes you 10 hours out of the day to do that, then you're going to be stuck in a situation where you're going to be able to only free up some people to pay attention to all that, while the others are producing the necessary underlying foundation so the society can exist and people can pay attention to those things. Now, Stalin's only way of dealing with that is, let's just build up the underlying base, leaving the rest of the relations alone, and more or less not changing the thinking of the people or the political institutions in a thoroughgoing way. And when we get enough abundance, then we can start reducing the hours and freeing more people up to do that. In the meantime, we'll make sure that engineers are coming from the working class and technicians are being selected out of the working class along the lines of what you were saying. Now, Mao had a different approach than that. He said we have to do the same thing simultaneously and in dialectical, back and forth with each other. Let's transform some of these things so that we're right now combining scientists with people who are not professional sciences in the sciences, teachers with people with students and others who are not professionals in the field of education when we decide on policy and thrash out ideas in the realm of education, and so on down the line, so that we're working to overcome these differences at the same time as we're working to create the material basis to where we can reduce the time that everybody has to spend just in reproducing the material requirements of life and the necessities for disasters and attack and enough to reproduce on an expanding basis. That was what Mao was seeking to do through the Cultural Revolution, for example, and indeed through the Chinese Revolution as a whole. Now, the problem you run into is, for all these inequalities that I've mentioned, there are forces in society who benefit from them. And they will spontaneously, at least some of them, resist these changes. You know, they talked during the Cultural Revolution in China about some people who said, "This is my stop. This is where the this is my bus stop. This is where I get off." In other words, this revolution has gone far enough. Now it's starting to touch some of the privilege that I have, so that's enough. You know, and that they didn't want to go completely beyond the horizon of bourgeois right. It was okay until it really started touching them. But that's not the real problem. Look, you know, people with more privileged positions, we're going to have to unite a lot of people like that in order to overthrow capitalism and in order to advance to communism. The question is, what line is in command and what's being unleashed? Because with people like that, if you go to them with a line that rationalizes their more selfish side, if you want to put it that way, that gives them a rationalization for their privilege, and you appeal to them on that basis, you can unleash them around that. Whereas if you go to them with a line and with forces in motion around the idea that we should overcome these inequalities and really it'll be a much fuller and richer life for everybody, you can also win them, many of them, to that line. The problem was that the leadership of the Chinese Party, the line that wanted to appeal to the privilege of these people won out after Mao died and was in very serious contention during the time Mao was alive, and that's why they had a cultural revolution, or one of the main reasons, and why there were these continual battles right down until the time Mao died. And you can see how this works. It isn't that, you know, even the Deng Xiaopings, well, Deng Xiaoping, I think, just didn't give a fuck about socialism or capitalism. He said so. You know, it doesn't matter if a cat is black cat or a white cat, as long as it catches mice. Meaning, it doesn't matter if we use socialist or capitalist principles, as long as we develop the economy and make China a powerful country. So, but there are other people who could be appealed to by Deng Xiaoping, not on the basis of straight up, you know, let's just use any old method. Who cares if we're building socialism? But they could be appealed to on the basis of rationalizing their privileges, and that would happen like saying, look. This is a waste of the time of people with intellectual knowledge to have them go out and spend part of their time integrating with the peasants. It's detracting from and it's undermining developing the economy so that the peasants' life can really improve. Well, if you're someone who, you know, you know, you're a professor and somebody's telling you have to go to the countryside for a year, that sounds like a pretty good line, you know what I mean? You know, it rationalizes your staying where you are. And, you know, we have to sum up more about how all that was handled. There is a definite, you know, role for the role of intellectuals and people working with ideas in socialist society in an even bigger way than in capitalist society. And we need that. We need the ferment that intellectuals create by wrangling with ideas. But we also need them not to retreat entirely into a privileged enclave. So this is a contradiction Mao is trying to deal with. We need to wrestle with more. But let's remember the reality here. You hear all these individual horror stories about the Cultural Revolution. This professor had to go out to the countryside, et cetera, et cetera. And again, I say there are things to sum up positively and negatively. We should learn more and do better. But the basic underlying fact is, at that time, 600 million or more of the 800 million people in China were peasants in the countryside, and nobody asked them if they wanted to be in the countryside. They didn't have any choice about whether they were in the countryside or not. That's where they were. They were doing the labor to produce the food to feed people. So this is a profound inequality that you have to figure out the correct means for overcoming. And you have to do that in dialectical relation with developing the underlying material abundance so that you have more of a material basis to free people to overcome these divisions. If you let the inequalities run rampant, then no matter how you develop the economy, it doesn't matter because you're just going to get a polarized society that'll go back to capitalism. If you restrict those things more than you can actually do at a given time in line with what the level of your abundance is, you will make errors on the other side and undermine and sabotage your economy and strengthen the argument of those who want to insist that there's no way to do this other than the Deng Xiaoping way of just giving, you know, which more was like the Stalin model, just giving emphasis to the city, to industry, to the more privileged and mental workers, and just someday that'll all trickle down. It's a trickle-down ideology, actually, just like Reaganism. only in the form of in the shell of socialism, it'll trickle down to the peasants and workers eventually. So how do you correctly handle that contradiction of overcoming these differences to the greatest degree that you can at a given time, while also building up your abundance so that you have more material basis to go farther with overcoming those inequalities? This is a real problem that we've run into in the socialist revolution. And frankly, it'd be a lot easier to solve if we didn't have the imperialists out there. Because then we can make mistakes and not pay so heavily for them. We could adjust more easily. But when you add into the picture the other thing I was talking about, where you have these encirclement and constant threat from the imperialists, and you have to devote a lot of your economy, frankly, to producing armaments and means of equipping and training an army, that also tends to distort things. Now, Stalin went way off with that. He that need to develop armaments completely accentuated his tendency to rely very one-sidedly on heavy industry. And from the early 30s on, that's the way they went. So that even though they survived World War II, by the time it was over, there wasn't much socialism left, and it was easy for Khrushchev to come in and restore capitalism. Mao did a lot better with these contradictions, but at the same time, we can see the objective limitations they ran into, and we can also learn more about some of the errors that might have been made. You know, questions are raised about how they handled people in the arts, for example, whether it was too tight a rein on people. And, you know, in other spheres of, you know, the sciences and the intellectual pursuits in general. That's something we're looking into now, trying to study and understand more and sift out what's true from what's not true and what was right about what they did and what were the mistakes and shortcomings and how can we do better. You know, one of the things they tried to do, for example, in the arts was and made great, you know, breakthroughs and achievements and was bringing forward revolutionary literature and art and culture, which had never existed before. First of all, put the mass of people on the stage, which never really happens in any consistent way. But even more importantly, it brought forward revolutionary themes and provided revolutionary inspiration to people to transform the society, to support world revolutionary struggles, and so on. And that took a tremendous amount of work and struggle to produce what were called these model operas, which is a Peking opera is a very popular form in China, and the films they made of some of the operas and ballets and things like that. And so it took them years of concerted, concentrated attention to bring these things into being. And every step of the way, they were opposed by people like Deng Xiaoping and before him, Liu Shaoqi, another leader of the Chinese party, who argued that you're destroying all the traditional culture in China. And besides, you're putting too much effort into this to the detriment of developing the economy. But so that was an important breakthrough. The ballet was actually world-class ballet they created. Artistically and technically of any kind. And it was also a very high in revolutionary content. But then there's a question of, in the midst of very intense struggle over all this, was it too tight a rein put on the artist so that the kind of very calibrated, calculating attention you have to pay to something like bringing a new thing like a revolutionary opera into being can't be applied to every artistic work that anybody's trying to do? That was the point I was trying to make or when I was talking about elasticity. You can't apply that or else you'll suffocate things. And people will not be able, the creative impulse and experimentation in the arts will get restricted and suffocated. So this is another tough contradiction. How do you handle that correctly? Because look, when you're not existing in a vacuum, if you give artists funds to go off and just create art, some of them are going to come back in 2 years and say, I ran into writer's block, I didn't produce anything. You've been subsidizing them, and maybe you've been also have a policy that they should take part in some, manual productive labor to contribute to the society, which is good. But, you've been subsidizing them. Well, there's risks in doing that. It isn't like this comes free. The peasants and workers who are working are producing wealth, and the people who are helping to plan and administer this are making their contribution to provide the material foundation under which these artists are doing this. So you pay a price for that. So it's an intense contradiction. How do you actually give a lot of initiative to people to be creative and yet keep it, in line with what the material basis is at a given time and where you need to go with that and all these complicated interaction of things to produce these transformations that I've been talking about. And these are some of the things we need to sum up more fully. How, you cannot have people really wrestling with something like, Kuhn's theses, or all this struggle that's now still once again going on in the realm of science and the philosophy of science about Popper's, insistence that Marxism is not a science because it can't be falsified. These, in order for people to really wrangle with these things, it takes time. You have to be able to get into it. You can't come, I read this book by Barbara Ehrenreich, who's a social democrat, you know, sort of reformist socialist. And she wrote this book called Nickeled and Dimed, which some of you may have read. And it's, she is an intellectual, a very highly developed intellectual and writer. And she talked about doing a lot of these jobs, like waitress in a restaurant, one of these jobs where you go and clean people's homes, what it's called, Molly Maid or whatever, you know. And then and another one where she worked for Kmart. And she described, you know, and she's working among, you know, people of all different nationalities, a lot of poor white people too, and they described how people are just totally consumed with his work. They're often living out of their cars, living in, you know, in cheap motel rooms. And she said that even she, after a few days, didn't even feel like reading anymore. And certainly she couldn't write anything because of just the weight of the drudgery of work. Well, if you want people to engage in the arts and intellectual pursuits and, you know, debate about black holes and whether they really suck everything in or don't, which is a very important question for humanity, you have to allow for that. You can't completely wear people out to where they're like Barbara Ehrenreich. They can't even think. But there's a contradiction there. You can see the contradiction, because if they do vote the necessary attention to that, they're going to get away from the practical requirements of life that other people are supplying for them. So how do you correctly get the right synthesis on that so that they don't, you know, that all this inequality doesn't get reinforced while at the same time you have the necessary ferment going on? So these are some of the dimensions that we're wrestling with and I'm wrestling with now about how the next time around, how do we handle this better? Because we know what some of the objective problems are. But how do you keep, one of the things that I've been emphasizing, you have to have a united front not only to overthrow this system, but you have to have a united front led by the proletariat and its party all the way through this transition. So how do you keep that going so that you're continuing on the direction toward communism, but you're embracing and bringing forward, while yes, struggling with, all these diverse forces, including those who at any given time occupy a more privileged position? And this is one of the main methodological things that I think we need to pay continuing attention to and need to learn how to do better in, because we're going to face this necessity. These people who want to go back the old way, even inside the party, people arise who want to do that. It's one of the lessons of the Chinese Revolution. They brought that out clearly to us. How do you defeat those lines inside the party at the same time in a society as a whole? You keep it moving in a revolutionary direction and draw broader and broader ranks and layers of the masses into actually running and transforming the society while defending your revolution against those people who want to destroy it. And our first round, you know, if you look at it with a historical perspective, you know, in the United States, the bourgeoisie had a revolution, and it wasn't a very good one, you know, in the 1770s. They had a revolution. They couldn't even get rid of slavery with their bourgeois revolution. It took them 100 years to get rid of slavery. Really, they didn't complete their bourgeois democratic revolution until the Civil War. And the bourgeoisie, beyond that, excuse me, has been around a long time. And it took them a long time even to get their shit more or less right and to defeat their enemies. And we're trying to do something much more profound, is to uproot all this oppression, exploitation, and inequality. And we've had one round. And really, you know, historically speaking, we're still in the early stages of this. But we have to learn all these lessons. How do you deal with these objective contradictions? What's the correct methodology to deal with them? And how do we defeat these attempts to turn us back the next time? How do we do much better? And this is why even now, when unfortunately we don't yet have socialist states, while we're putting a lot of attention in how to get some, how to make revolution, including right here, we also have to be thinking about all these kinds of contradictions, partly because, you know, we are going to get there and we're going to need to deal with them, and also because people now need to understand these questions in order to see the need to make revolution and the possibility of advancing it and not getting turned back. Because if people are convinced either that it's impossible or that, yes, every time you do it, it just goes back to the old thing, why bother? Then they're not going to be motivated and inspired to want to do this. So you raise a very important question. I wish I could give a very nice, neat, clear answer to it. But I think it's more falls, at least to my understanding, in the category of these are some of the problems and contradictions we have to keep hammering at.
I wonder if you could say a few words about the 9/11 Commission report. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it. It's over 500 pages. I haven't read it myself, but what I have read, it seems to me as though it's fundamentally a whitewash, a bipartisan whitewash. Each party washing each other.
It's quite an
but
image.
But there's also it also seems to me as though there's a lot of good exposure in there, particularly on a number of points, including the overall point that they aren't in control. I mean, it seems like a very important bulwark of their rule is the illusion that they are in control of everything and that they're working on behalf of the to protect people, and people are willing to give up this and that and kill people halfway across the world because they feel like they're being protected somehow. And I think that there's a lot of good exposure in there. I wonder if you'd had a chance to think about it much.
Well, I haven't had a chance to read the report itself, so I can't comment directly on it. I have seen some of the press conferences that were held as they were releasing it. I did watch some of the hearings as they were different aspects of the hearings. And, well, so I really can't comment on it directly, but I do think what my sense is along the lines of what you said from these earlier things that I did watch, which is that they were, on the one hand, trying to cover over the deeper, you know, the more profound things involved, including, you know, that and trying to cast things in a certain light. The real question is, how do we better fight the war on terrorism? I think that's my sense is that's one of the main objectives, and to sweep away the question, more fundamental questions of, you know, why is this happening, and you know, really, what role do we play in the world in any way, which of course they're not going to want to address. But I think that is one of the, at least in the buildup I've seen to it, one of the clear purposes. I think your other point, without having read the report in general, is a very important point, though. I think people come to see the need for a revolution, for example, when they feel not only that the right of the old ruling class to rule is called into question, but even their ability to rule. And this is something that's important not to underestimate. It's sort of a combination of when people feel, for example, I was talking about the monopoly of legitimate violence. When people come to feel that the violence of the ruling class and its institutions and instruments is no longer legitimate, that's one of the key things that goes into creating a crisis that not automatically but could lead to a revolutionary situation. That happened on a very broad scale in the 60s and into the early 70s with the whole combination of the uprisings in the cities and protests and rebellions and the Vietnam War. Huge swaths of the society began to feel that the violence being used by the rulers of this country was illegitimate. But what inevitably almost goes along with that, or, you know, pretty much as a feature of a development of an overall revolutionary situation, is this aspect of people also feeling, I think is what you're touching on, that the ruling class also doesn't have the ability to rule, that it isn't able to hold things together in the way that people are accustomed to them, even if the way they're, quote-unquote, accustomed to is no good. I mean, these are the revolutions are not pure things. That's one thing we have to say. It's not everybody wakes up one day and says, I've got a complete communist understanding of everything. Let's go out and make a revolution. Or I thoroughly reject everything that this system is about, so I'm ready for revolution. It's a combination of their becoming more and more alienated and disgusted in a profound way with the system, with a feeling that the people who run it are no longer capable of providing the functions of rule that they are accustomed to being provided, or that their ability to do so is seriously undermined. I think this is an important element that sometimes can get overlooked. And, you know, like, for example, in the Russian Revolution, one of the things that they actually did was that they, you know, they were at war with Germany, and they had to organize defense against Germany at the same time as they were making the revolution. Even as Lenin was saying, we don't take a stand of uniting with our ruling class to persecute or prosecute this war. So things can be complex, and the question of who is going, it can come right down to where one key element, and it can be, who is actually going to be able to provide the functions of rule and government that the people need? When you get to an extreme crisis, a lot of times things that swing not the most advanced section of the people, but intermediate sections of the people, more toward the side of revolution, is when they see that the old way and the old institutions and the old ruling structures no longer can do these things as well as these new forces who come forward who have a better solution to these things. In Russia, it was that the Bolsheviks promised to pull Russia out of the war and end the war, end the participation of the Russian people in that war, and they were sick of that war. The peasants were paying in the millions for that war because they mainly made up the army, and they were drafted into it. And no other party was willing to get out of that war. All the reformist socialists and everything insisted on continuing the war because they didn't see any way that they could break with the whole structure of capitalism. And the Russian government had made commitments and alliances with Britain and France, and the U.S. was getting in. And no other party was willing to rupture out of that war. So when it came down to it, people felt that the continuation of the war one more day was intolerable on the one hand, and the only party that would get them out of it was the Bolsheviks. And that's, in a way, a certain expression of the kind of thing you're talking about. So without having read it, though, I do think that generally the element you're raising is very important.
In some of the reports in the Revolutionary Worker and also in A World to Win, there have been, I guess, reports of, like, joint conferences in Southeast Asia of, you know, the various Maoist parties and formations, which sounds like to me like a real kind of a new development in the international communist movement, and also with the reunification or the unification of the Communist Party of Afghanistan. They make particular reference to the Maoists in Iran and helping and assisting their development. And also, I think in the past you've mentioned something about the sort of relationship between revolution in this country and revolution in Mexico, that they may have a great deal of interpenetration. And there actually is a link in what I'm trying to say here. But they seem to be sort of new things, because I know in the past it's pretty much kind of been, in the past there's been sort of like, you know, each party in each country has to analyze the specific conditions in its own country. But there seems to be like a development here, having to do with the rim and more of the development of the rim, and having at least more regional or even international sort of analysis and working together to strategize. I wonder if you could just comment on that.
Well, yes. Like, one of the important things about our party is that we are affiliated with the Revolutionary Internationalist Movement, the RIM, which you referred to. And there's a general principle of internationalism that has to be a guiding principle of everything we do, which is that we're all part of a world revolution, and as Lenin put it, we don't approach it from my country, but my contribution to that overall world revolution. And that's been sort of a bedrock thing that we fought for in our party, to be a principle from which we proceed. And this is also something which is a foundational principle of the RIM, internationalism in that kind of sense. But there's also, about 20 years ago, I gave a talk called Advancing the World Revolution, Questions of Strategic Orientation. And one of the points I stressed there is that at any given time, besides the overall application of the principle of internationalism, it's important to not just look from each country out, but to look on a world scale and see where is it that the objective and subjective conditions come together that make it possible to make a real and the most important breakthroughs at a given time. In other words, where is the, what I mean by objective conditions, where are the things ripest for revolution in terms of the conflicts in society, the contradictions in how they're shaping up, and the sentiments and desire of the people for radical change? And then on the other hand, where do you have revolutionary parties in a position to lead that to where it needs to go? So that besides just the general principle of internationalism, there's also a principle of trying to see where you should be identifying key places that breakthroughs could be made on a world scale or for the whole world revolution, and then concentrate attention on that. Now, the RIM doesn't work by, you know, some center trying to run everybody's revolution. You know, that doesn't work. There are some errors that were made in that direction in the history of the international communist movement with the Communist International under Stalin's leadership. They did a lot of good things, and they assisted a lot of revolutions, including in China. But sometimes also things were done too centrally and with too heavy a hand, where they tried to run everything out of, you know, the center of this Communist International. That's not the way the RIM, that's not the basis on which the RIM operates. It's a question of building political support, and it's a question of, you know, carrying out struggle about principles, and then people have to apply them concretely in the struggle they're in. So, like, neither the RIM, you know, center nor our party tries to go around telling everybody, and if we did, it'd be, you know, how to make their revolution, which would be a big mistake. But what you can do, as I said, is try to figure out where, if you could make a breakthrough, where do you have the best basis and where would it have the biggest impact on the whole world if you make a breakthrough? And then try to encourage and support that politically. And that's, I think, that kind of thing is reflected in the things that you were mentioning. You know, obviously, in an overall strategic sense, the South Asia is an extremely important part of the world. There are, you know, more than a billion oppressed masses in that part of the world. And there is a whole history of you know, a communist movement and a Maoist movement in that part of the world as well. So whatever gains are made in uniting the revolutionary forces in that part of the world, and to the degree they're able to make breakthroughs there and build off of, for example, the momentum of what's happening in Nepal to push things forward in the whole region, that is of real strategic importance for the whole world revolution. That, you know, and the imperialists will recognize that and act accordingly also. We should be very aware and have no illusions. Because if something starts happening on a whole higher level in that part of the world, including specifically in India, that's going to change a lot of things in the world. The imperialists are not going to like it, and they're not going to like anybody who's supporting it or saying anything good about it. And that's the price you pay for being an internationalist, and that's the price you have to pay. So we have to recognize the stakes here, and also, you know, that for their side, but also for our side, this is strategically important. It's not the only important region, and you mentioned Afghanistan. Obviously, that whole arc that includes Afghanistan and Iran and all there is extremely important strategically as well. And, you know, whatever advances can be made there will also have a big impact on the whole world. So this is a kind of a way we try to approach things. It's not just, I shouldn't say simply, because it's not a minor thing, not only practicing the kind of internationalism that proceeds from not my country out, but how can I make the biggest, or how can we collectively as a party make the biggest contribution to the world revolution, but also at the same time, how can we look at the world as a whole and try to understand where the factors come together that make possible the biggest breakthroughs that would push the whole thing forward.
I was wondering, what do you think? How do you think the the new world order and sort of the unification of the world economy and the drag down of all the peoples in the developed countries and the underdeveloped countries, and this sort of making of a one united world under capitalist oppression, how this is going to affect the revolution? Like, the United States right now is stretched very, very thin in just handling two countries, but it's screwing the whole world, and it's even screwing the people in the United States. And it sounds like the capitalists are heading towards some bad territories where they may get the whole world revolting or ready to revolt at one time, and then we can have our world revolution. We won't have to worry about socialism in one country.
Well, that would be good. you know, whatever we can at any given time wrench away from the imperialists is so much the better, and strengthens our, you know, our struggle to go on and liberate the whole world. However, even with imperialism further extending and more deeply penetrating with its exploitation throughout the world, this doesn't happen evenly everywhere in the world. And you can see this in very real terms. If you work, for example, in an auto plant in the United States, you'll make 10 times as much money as somebody doing the same job in Mexico. And that's why they like to move a lot of those production facilities to Mexico and close them here. So it's not even, it's differentiated. You could go down the same, as badly as people are exploited, and they're viciously exploited in garment centers in this country, for example. If you work in the same occupation, more or less, in so many other countries of the third world, you'd be much more brutally exploited. So it's uneven. It isn't evenly distributed, even while it is more globalized. And also, the effect on people in this country is not a uniform effect. In other words, the fact that people are, you know, their standard of living may be stagnating or going down, or, you know, that their job security is not what it was, or their jobs don't carry the benefits they did, doesn't necessarily push everybody in short-term sense more toward revolution. In fact, a lot of the response to this on the part of people who've been used to a little bit better situation than the real bedrock of the proletariat is to move to the right. You know, there's this book out that I was talking with someone, and they recommended this book called What's the Matter with Kansas? And it's about this strata of people who used to work, like in Wichita, for example, in the aerospace industry, or the small farmers in Kansas who are like losing their jobs or being fired and rehired at much lower wages without the same benefits. You know, the unions are being pushed out a lot of places. The small farmers are being ruined by big agriculture. But a lot of them are going to the right. Well, the right. And not immediately to the left or toward revolution. And this is, you know, I think what the author of this book actually misses is he sort of presents it, this is the working class. But what it really is more, you know, what Lenin called an aristocracy of labor, or people who are more bourgeoisified in their position, and actually small, you know, small property owners, small petty bourgeois, like small farmers and people like that, who are being more crushed and pushed down by this. And their initial reaction a lot of times is to want to defend and try to get back the privileges that they had relative to their situation now. And a lot of times this goes along with a turn toward the right socially and culturally, you know, in the sense of like the whole society is going to hell. You know, and it's all because, you know, they're vulnerable to this appeal. It's all because we drove God out of the classroom back in the early 60s, which if you think about it, is quite an achievement, you know. You know, if God really were in the classroom, it'd be really quite an achievement to drive God out. But anyway, you know, this is their view. You know, we can't have prayer anymore in the public schools and so on. And, you know, and then we have abortion, and then we have evolution, and all these kind of things are just, you know, denying the centrality of God and of, you know, man as God's special creator. They're vulnerable to this kind of stuff because it's kind of a, you know, it goes along with a certain feeling that the things they had come to assume were sort of rightfully theirs, even though they weren't the ruling class or even rich, but were sort of rightfully theirs, a certain standard of living and so on, is being denied to them. And so this presents a complex challenge where we're going to have to do a lot of work and struggle to win people away from this and to win them to a position of supporting a real struggle against a system that is actually doing this to them. I mean, one of the things that this guy pointed, the guy is a good writer, the guy who wrote this book. I think he's the editor of that magazine, The Baffler. Yeah. What, it's Thomas Franks? Yeah. And he's a fairly good writer, and he captures some of the irony of this. You know, one of the things we have to understand is there's a whole phenomenon of right-wing populism in the U.S., which is a very big phenomenon. And it actually goes back to people like Wallace and Nixon and people around him. And it's opposed to more sort of left-wing populism in this way. Left-wing populism, like say, as identified with Ralph Nader, for example, identifies the corporations and all that kind of thing as the people who are the ones ruining the country. They are the ones who are squeezing the people, you know, who had a more middle-class life, or people who are working people, or, you know, are having a worse time because of the corporations. And they see the corporations controlling the political structure and controlling the media. And there's some truth to that, except they don't see it as a whole system which has to operate the way it does, and they think it can be reformed. But that's a kind of present-day left-wing populism. Right-wing populism identifies intellectuals, the limousine liberals in Hollywood, and anybody who tries to think as being part of the elite that's ruining the society, especially if they occupy any kind of privilege at all. And so this is a very different kind of populism. It's a know-nothing kind of populism that opposes any kind of urbane or cosmopolitan approach to anything and wants very simple, absolute answers to everything and identifies people who are a little bit, you know, or even quite a bit more privileged as being the enemy. And one of the things this guy Frank points out, the irony is that, you know, he says, well, you know, what happens is people like Ann Coulter, for example, who's like, you know, from New Canaan, Connecticut, one of the most privileged enclaves in the entire country, goes around, you know, parading around as the spokesperson for the common people, you know, denouncing the liberal elitists who don't like all the common people, you know. But what happens is, And they mobilize people in this kind of way to sort of seek these absolutist answers. And they portray, you know, the enemy as people, you know, who think they're smarter than everybody else and who really have an easy life. You know, people who, you know, may, you know, live in, you know, relatively well-off circumstances and have a fair amount of money and travel around and that kind of thing. Some of whom are actually quite progressive, but it's sort of a narrow, petty revenge line against these people that's mobilized by this, you know, conscious right-wing force within the ruling class and with connections right to the ruling class. And this guy Frank points out one of the ironies. Well, they hate these Hollywood people so much, these Hollywood limousine liberals, wealthy people in Hollywood, that the Republicans come along and they follow the Republicans and lower the taxes of all these people in Hollywood every year. You know, so there's a lot of ironies tied up in this, but the point is that there needs to be, you know, to use your earlier phrase, a paradigm shift here. There needs to be a radical rupture so that people understand how, you know, we have to bring to people an understanding of how this system actually works and where this is actually coming from. And what's the way out of this? At the same time, this isn't just going to get handled in the realm of ideas. It is necessary to bring forward and much more powerfully onto the stage a force of the real proletariat at the base of society, the ones who are really most viciously and brutally exploited and impoverished by the working of this system. Bring them forward who have a much more of a bedrock interest in this proletarian revolution. And the more that they're brought forward in conjunction with struggling with these broader strata, the more we're going to be able to influence and win them toward the right position instead of actually objectively operating and acting against their own interests on the basis of resentment at having a few privileges taken away. But it's not going to be simply in the realm of ideas. There's an urgent need to bring forward among the youth and in the proletariat broadly, and particularly at the base of society, a real revolutionary force which can have a tremendous impact even in terms of influencing these other strata when combined with the correct revolutionary work with them. So I think it would be nice if we could just solve it all in one big, you know, in one fell swoop. We could get everything. You know, then, you know, we could all go to a movie and relax. But the problem is, you know, and I believe in going to movies and relaxing, but even while we're doing everything we have to do. But nonetheless, you know, it's not going to be that easy, and we're in for a long struggle, and it is going to be one or a few countries at a time, and then we're going to have to fight to defend them while we go on and make further advances. And it's going to be that kind of back-and-forth process, I'm afraid, rather than one fell swoop. So as much as I can unite with your sentiment and would love to see that, I think the reality is not going to go that way.
During the 70s, I remember that in Mexico there was a Communist Party. It just disappeared and it became the PRD. Then we have the indigenous people from the Zapatistas, you know, took arms and started like a small revolution. Now in Tijuana and all over the border, NAFTA, they're closing the maquiladoras and they're moving it to Southeast Asia where they can pay $1.25 a day. My question is, what do you think is going to happen to Mexico? Because the people cannot cross over due to gatekeeper, triple fence they're trying to build and all that. Do you think like Mexico will be, it's like a time bomb for a revolution? And what kind, or it's just going to be another nationalist or what? I'm very concerned. Soy Mexicana. That's what I'm asking you.
Well,
thank you.
Even without being Mexicano, we can still be very concerned. and it is a very good question. It goes actually back to, you actually raised this earlier, and I didn't speak to that part of what you raised, so I'm glad, that's another reason why I'm glad you brought this up. I think the point is that, going back, beginning with what he was raising, the point of orientation that we were stressing is that you can't, in our party, you can't really conceive of a revolution either in the United States or in Mexico in which there isn't a great effect of the one on the other. They're not one country. In fact, they're very different kinds of countries. One's a very advanced imperialist country as far as its economy, and the other is a country dominated by imperialism. But they still are very closely interconnected in many ways, not only along border. But there are many economic links. Even as you say, they're closing down the maquiladoras, and they are sending these jobs to Asia, or whatever you want to put it that way. And it's sort of, it's sort of a full, a display of the grotesque nature of imperialism. First, they ruin like all these peasants in Mexico. Then the women, in particular, forced to go work in the maquiladoras. And then, after brutally exploiting them and sexually harassing them and everything else, then they close it down and leave them to whatever. You know, so this is the workings of imperialism over and over and over again. But you cannot conceive. There's all these economic links, nonetheless. You know, heavy U.S. investment. There's a lot of influence of what happens in the American economy in terms of Mexico and the other way around. So when you try to step back and look strategically, although these are two different revolutions, they are going to very closely interconnect and influence each other. For example, if there is a revolution that really begins to gain momentum in Mexico, it is impossible to imagine that the U.S. ruling class is going to stand around and say, let's see what happens. So, they're going to move very early and try to move very decisively to crush that. On the other side of that, there are a lot of people who are in this country who are originally or very recently from Mexico, as well as much broader sections of people who can be won to or will immediately be inclined to support that struggle in Mexico. And that, in turn, will have a major effect on the political struggle and the development toward revolution in this country. And back and forth it will go. And the more that things advance in this country, obviously that'll have a big impact in Mexico as well, in terms of inspiring people, but also in terms of, shaking some things loose further in Mexico itself. Now, as for your point about where all this is going to go, throughout, the whole history, Mao pointed this out about China, of any country, wherever people are oppressed, as he pointed out, wherever there's oppression, there'll be resistance. And the problem with the Communist Party in Mexico is it was what we call a revisionist party, a party that was communist in name but really reformist and, reinforcing and upholding capitalism in deeds. And eventually when the Soviet Union collapsed or was on its way to collapsing, there was no more basis for that party given what its whole orientation and program had been. And then there was the Zapatista uprising, but very quickly they abandoned the idea. I mean, if you go back and look at the original proclamation of the Zapatistas, they put out things about marching on the Capitol. Like orders to the Zapatista army, march to the Capitol. Well, they very quickly abandoned that. They were not really in any position to do that. And it was an uprising that should have been and was supported by people like our party because it represented oppressed masses rising up. But it didn't represent the road forward out of all this for the masses of oppressed people. And now they become bogged down totally in reformism and even making a principle that you shouldn't go for power. The key link in terms of in any country to be able for the uprisings of the mass of people, which will repeatedly happen, and have repeatedly happened in any country that you can look at, is whether or not they get a leadership that has the ideology and program to develop that into a revolution and not just to have it either spend itself or be brutally crushed. Mao pointed out in China, for example, that for hundreds and thousands of years there were uprisings of peasants. And one of three things would happen with the uprisings of peasants. One, they would be brutally crushed. Two, they would win victory, but the leaders of the uprising itself would become the head of the existing dynasty. Or three, they'd start a whole new dynasty. But the system never changed. And he said the reason was because China didn't yet have a proletariat, a class whose interests lay in abolishing all exploitation, and it didn't have a Communist Party that could recognize that and lead people in that direction. And this is a crucial thing for people. It is not a question whether people will rise up against oppression. They will continually, repeatedly, and heroically. The question is, will they get a real Communist Party, one based on the most advanced ideology, which today means Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, that can actually, not in some magical way, just wave away all the problems, but through all the twists and turns, difficulties, setbacks, can keep the revolution going forward and can actually take people on the road that can lead them out of all that. That's the key thing in any country. And whenever that comes together with the deepening desire of growing numbers of people to make revolution, then you have the potential to actually do so. And when that happens in Mexico, it is going to very closely interconnect and with things happening in the U.S., and this can either be reinforced in a mainly negative or mainly positive way. And that depends a lot on what people do, people who have a consciousness of this in particular. In other words, if we leave it to the ruling class, they're going to make it negative on both sides of the border. But if we work on it consciously from the point of view of a revolutionary understanding, of a communist understanding, then we can get that back and forth going in a positive way through all the very difficult sacrifices that will be required to actually do that. So this is how we have to look at it from a larger strategic perspective. It's two different countries, two different revolutions, but they're very closely interconnected. And one of the main ways they interconnect, frankly, is people just like you who actually are from one country and in the other and provide actually a very important link. But again, it isn't just people like you who have an interest in and who care about this and who should care about it, because this is our goal is to emancipate all of humanity. And if we can get our struggle going back and forth in a positive way between here and Mexico as things develop in the two countries, that could have a tremendous impact. And it could also be a very favorable factor for revolution in this country, even with all the difficulties, as well as a strength for the developing revolution in Mexico. So that's the way that our party looks at that. And that's the way we have to, lead more and more people to understand the stakes of what's involved here.